If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's a Tuesday afternoon. On Tuesdays, we check in with John Najeri. You see him on CNBC. Follow him on Twitter at Option Monster. And John, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has taken off here, and it looks like in the past 20 or 30 minutes. I know Boeing, Caterpillar, a couple of local companies have been doing well in this surge. But what's behind this big jump?
Well, it's certainly not crude oil, although it has made a little bit of a comeback since Orion's update. It was down around 28 and 50 cents or so, and now it's come back about 47, 48 cents, back over 29, and that's dollars per barrel, of course, for the U.S. WTI. But it's still down about 1.3% on the day, so it doesn't seem to be a very significant driver, but the fact that a couple nations have agreed to production cuts, freezes.
Right.
Different than cuts. has, I guess, oil stabilizing at least a little.
So we've got Saudi Arabia, Russia, Qatar, Venezuela saying that they will freeze their production. But we're still waiting to hear right from Iran and Iraq, a couple of big producers. And it seems to me they'd be less likely to go along with this.
Yeah, in particular, of course, Iran just coming back onto the global market.
They're just back in the game.
Exactly. So I think the others are just more or less trying to do something to stabilize the price of crude, which everybody from Goldman Sachs on down had been saying was in all likelihood going to see a trade below $20 a barrel. At least some freezing of the production might mean that we don't see those lows for quite some time.
What do you make? I was just reading there's a new Fed governor, and I don't have it in front of me, but I think he's out of Minnesota, maybe.
Yep, Neel Kashkari.
Yeah, talking the Bernie Sanders talk that some of the banks in this country still are too big to fail.
Yeah, and that's surprising coming from a guy who made his fortune over at Goldman Sachs.
Well, he's got his.
And then he left Goldman and went to PIMCO, another massive financial institution owned by Allianz out of Germany. But nonetheless, Pacific Management is the U.S. division of Allianz. And now he's, of course, a Fed governor, still has to be one of the youngest Fed governors on there. I believe he's just over 40, if that. And I guess it's a populist theme that he's reiterating, like you say, the Bernie Sanders message that there are some of these banks on Wall Street and some financial institutions, maybe the two he worked for, that are too big to fail.
So what does, when a guy like that makes comments, and he's new to the Fed board, but does that hold much sway? I mean, does that have much influence on the market?
I think the fact that it's becoming more popular, again, to bash the banks, they've, of course, spent a lot of money backing at least one of the candidates in the race, Hillary Clinton.
Right.
And they're probably looking to get a little better return on that investment, if you will, because nobody gives these kind of dollars just to have access to the candidate. They're looking for a little support, if you will, Stephen. So I think they're probably not pleased with the direction things are going right now for them.
Are you telling me these contributions aren't all about patriotism?
I don't think it's all an arm's-length transaction. I think they're expecting a little something
They
give.
We talked, I think maybe it was last week or the week before, about which candidate Wall Street liked the most. And you said pretty quickly Hillary Clinton, and you brought it up again today. But so let's just go to the Republican side. Does Wall Street have a dog in the Republican hunt?
Well, that's well put, Stephen, and they probably do have a dog, and that is George Bush's brother, because Jeb was who Wall Street was betting on would be coming out of the Republican primaries, and instead he's just disappeared. I mean, he's barely in the single digits as far as polling data shows. Trump's backing himself. Cruz certainly not a darling of the Wall Street banks, although he is in New York a fair amount.
Doesn't his wife work for Goldman Sachs?
Exactly. Yeah. She's a former Goldman player as well. So if it got, if it just comes down to those two, there's no doubt of those two, Wall Street would go with Mr. Cruz over Mr. Trump, because Trump has already said he wants a number of sort of the perks of being a big, too big to fail player rolled back. And Cruz has not said that.
All right. So Bernie Sanders wins. It's a Bernie Sanders presidency. He's talking a tough talk. He's talking about having Wall Street pay for college education and all of that. Does any of that actually happen?
No. And he'd need to turn over the House and Senate as well, because, as you know, and I know you have a bunch of smart listeners, the president can make blustering statements about anything he or she wants. But they still have to get the legislative branch to go along with it, even things like immigration. You can go and, as the president, sitting president has, you could go and propose things, but that's all you can do is propose and maybe try to use the bully pulpit to move things around. But unless you can get legislation passed, the House and Senate, the House, of course, for the funding of whatever bills you'd like to get out there, and the Senate to make it a law after the House has decided how we're going to pay for it, then the president can sign it. Without that, there's very little other than declaring war and a couple other things that the president can do just by jawboning about it. He or she needs the support of the legislative branch.
And, you know, I think the bully pulpit doesn't even count anymore. I mean, there are issues where public sentiment, I'm thinking of background checks, where, you know, public sentiment is on the side of the president, but you still can't get anything to move through the Congress. All right, we just got a minute or so. So do you have a stock recommendation for me today?
Well, I was buying a lot of a company called Fold, F-O-L-D, and certainly hoping that they don't fold. That along with Groupon, by the way. Groupon got a nice investment today.
They need a new marketing chief there, I think, John.
A new marketing chief?
Yeah, Fold. You don't want to name a company Fold.
Well, probably not, except that its true name is Amicus Therapeutics.
Okay.
The symbol is F-O-L-D, and this is a company involved in biopharmaceutical. It's back down to the lowest levels it's seen in several years, and now bouncing about 5% off those levels. To give you a rough idea, it was a $19 stock a year ago. Now it's a $5 stock.
Wow.
So people are betting that some sort of positive trial results come out in the next few weeks.
John Najarian from CNBC. You can follow him on Twitter at Option Monster. Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
It's 12:22 here on 720 WGN. I'm Steve Bertrand. You're listening to The Business Lunch. Andrew Herman from DNA Info is here. He comes by most Tuesdays to talk about openings and closings in the city. And Andrew, I've probably known you for 25 years.
Yeah, probably.
Right?
Yeah, probably.
And learning something this week, I would have never put you in the motorcycle camp.
I don't look like a motorcycle guy to you?
No, you don't really. You don't
really?
Well, I don't know what that guy would look like.
I don't know how to take that.
I have to say though, the more you motorcycle guys get older, the more I'm surprised by how you like. I have a number of friends who I've met in the past 5 or 10 years. Turns out who they ride motorcycles.
Well, I haven't actually ridden my motorcycle for about 20 years.
How's it look?
It's been in the garage for 20 years. It's done a great job being, you know, the holder for the garden hoses and,
right,
and the Christmas ornaments and everything. But it just sits there in the corner. It's a sort of memory from my college years. I bought it for my first newspaper job.
Uh-huh.
In 1983. I had an internship at the Peoria Journal-Star, and they said, "You have a car, right?" And I said, "I got a way to get around." And I went out and I bought this Kawasaki 400 that was about 6 years old at the time for $500. And I just went from assignment to assignment on my little motorcycle.
And so you've had it for more than 30 years. Not a bad investment on $500.
Yeah, it was a very good investment.
Not that it's been driven in the past 15
years. No, you know, and I loved it. And I loved it through college. It was a great way to get around. But once I had kids, I started thinking, if I fall down on this thing and I lose an arm, this is going to be trouble for a lot of people.
So much trouble.
Yeah, that's right.
And that brings us to this Acme Cycles Chicago. It's on West Belmont, 4600 block of West Belmont. They are preying on guys like you.
Yeah, so this is in the Belmont-Cragen area. They mainly do high-end vintage and unusual type motorcycles, fix them up and sell them. We have in the story on the site today, there's a picture of a Chinese motorcycle with a sidecar, which is kind of cool. But one of the owners, Scott Lunt, says that a lot of people, probably my age, in their 50s and 40s, they have motorcycles in their garages.
You can pretend if you want.
They have motorcycles in their garages that they haven't ridden in years.
Right.
And they kind of specialize in fixing them up and getting them running again. And you
it's
know.
A nice little niche because I bet you are not alone. I bet there are a lot of bikes like that holding up Christmas decorations for the rest of the year.
The thing is, you have a motorcycle and you stop riding it, and it's not like you can put it out at the curb.
Right.
It just, you don't know what to do with it, and it's too big to throw away. And
how are we doing in motorcycles around the country?
Well, we're starting to see a little uptick, 3.8% last year, up to about 483,000 new ones sold. But that's still a far cry. That's less than half of during the sort of heyday of 2003 to 2006. So the recession came along, and
killed
that was a toy that people just could do without.
Well, that's the key, I think, isn't it? That around in the States, it's a toy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a principal means of transportation. Like you go to Europe, you know,
right.
The cities of Europe, and that's how thousands of people get around every day.
Right.
There aren't any commuters taking the bike into the city.
Right. If you look at forecasts globally, it's an increase because of a few different reasons. You know, some of these developing countries, the people have more disposable income now. This government push to reduce pollution,
right?
Get people out of cars. So these developing nations, instead of having everybody in a car, you know, a lot of people use motorcycles. And then there's these electric motorcycles that I guess are becoming very popular in Europe, in particular in Germany and in the Netherlands. And you can imagine how clean those things are.
I've heard of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if you've got a gas-guzzling motorcycle, if there's such a thing in your garage, check out Acme Cycle Chicago. They're at 4613 West Belmont. All right, we've got time for one more. Let's have a bite to eat right there in the north side there. I know there was Fork Restaurant, right? And there's Spoon.
Uh-huh.
And now we're getting an addition to the place setting?
Yes, the third piece of the cutlery. Knife is coming to 4343 North Lincoln Avenue.
Butter knife steak. Sounds like it's a steak knife.
Yeah, it's a steakhouse.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. So you have Fork, Spoon, and Knife all on Lincoln Avenue within three blocks from each other.
Are they related?
Well, Fork and Knife are. Spoon Spoon is a Thai restaurant. Fork is a gastropub, and Knife is a steakhouse. So we're awaiting the arrival of Spork.
Fork and Knife hang out together.
Right.
Spoon is sort of like the cousin who comes by from time to time.
Right.
The Thai cousin.
That's right. He's the Thai cousin. But so if you try to make up your mind, you can have Fork, Spoon, or Knife.
Right. Can you do so? None of them is a breakfast place.
I'm trying to think of doing all three. Spatula? I don't know.
What would be a
napkin?
Breakfast? No.
Bowl?
Saucepan?
Yeah.
Saucepan. Let's
go.
Do that.
All right.
Andrew Herman from DNA Info Chicago. Thanks for coming by.
Okay.
We'll take a break. Come back after this on the Business Lunch. Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Coming up later this half hour, we will talk to songwriter Shelley Pikand. You know her work. She's written songs for Christina Aguilera, for The Pretenders, platinum-selling records. And she will talk to us a little bit. She's got a book coming out, actually, called Confessions of a Serial Songwriter. And I want to talk to her about the business of songwriting in this digital age. It has changed quite a lot. First, though, Suzanne Muchen, the co-host of The Big Payoff, is in the studio. Suzanne, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Steve.
So Suzanne brings in different stories every week, and we talk about what do we talk about?
Women in the workplace.
Yeah,
women in the workplace, women in business.
And a lot of times that involves STEM education. And
science, technology, engineering, math.
Although I'm for STEAM.
Yes, to add the arts to it.
STEAM adds an A in there, and there's arts.
Yeah.
And then it just becomes general education.
Exactly, then it's education.
Which is what we should be doing anyway.
Right.
But so anyway, the idea is that girls are less likely to go into STEM fields, so there's a push to have them educated in STEM educations and all of that. I tend to feel like people find what they're interested in. And I know that maybe we can nibble around the edges a little bit. But so there was just this study done that showed that women, if they weren't being judged as women or men as men, that the coders, if you were women, tended to do better than the men.
This is a crazy study, I have to say, because it bursts the bubble of one of the biggest mantras out there about why more women aren't going into tech, which is that they don't have the STEM education, which puts them behind. We need to improve the pipeline. And it suggests that they don't actually have the right skills, to your point, because perhaps they're not pursuing this line of education.
Right.
But what this study shows is, in fact, they are darn good coders. So good that they beat their male counterparts, but only under one condition, which is when the coding is analyzed gender blind.
Right. So you don't know who's writing
the
code.
Nope.
Then the women tend to be judged better than the men.
They outperform their male counterparts.
But just barely, right?
Just barely. But
so basically, I'm going to say equal.
Yes, but given the narrative out there
right.
that women are so far behind the curve, this is a pretty, and it was done based on 3,000 coding processes with the website GitHub. So it's not just 10 situations. This was 3,000 different circumstances.
Right. And maybe I sounded too competitive there. Defensive.
You did a little bit.
I didn't mean to. So
I feel like you're getting a little defensive here. You don't like the author of this.
I don't. I'll tell you in a second.
I know that.
They found the code written by women was approved at a higher rate, 78.6%, than code written by men, 74.6. So a 4% difference there. Both
right.
at like 75% or so. So
right.
I mean, it's good. It's all good.
It bursts the myth. That's what's important.
The myth that
women really aren't excelling at the skills themselves.
Right.
Because they don't have STEM education. This suggests that they actually are very good at it. And perhaps the issue really is that their male counterparts aren't giving them the chance.
Well, maybe what it suggests is that women who are drawn to it are very good at it. Right? My whole issue is that I think we're sometimes forcing or pressuring girls to like something. Individual girls, not girls as a sex or, you know, as a gender. But individual girls are feeling pressure to do something that they might not be interested in.
Why would you think that girls aren't interested in STEM?
Because I'm not.
You're not a girl.
No, I know. But if I was going to school day
yeah.
after day and I was seeing all these posters and programs, girls love science, girls love math, you know, if they were saying Steve loves science, I'd be like, no, I really don't. Don't make me do it.
I don't know that the messaging out there is about loving these areas of study. I think it's about their potential to be good at them. There is a lot of data to show that women are generally raised, girls are generally raised thinking girls are good at English and history and boys are good at math and science. This is about perception change. I don't think it's about forcing people
right.
to study something they don't love.
Okay. Yeah, I don't like the author of the story, but I don't know GitHub. That's reputable.
It's an open source coding platform, so you can submit codes for approval
okay.
and use. So it's a pretty big study.
The author writes things like, if feminism has taught us anything, it's that almost all men are sexist.
Right. So she took it a little bit too far. I agree with that.
Despite misogynistic suggestions that women have no place
there.
In STEM.
Do you notice how I left those quotes out of my summary for you? Didn't even mention that.
You know I read beyond the summaries.
It's a problem.
You know that I do. All right. So we talk about quotas as well. This is fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Well, there's a couple things. There's one are the efforts at quotas in Middle Eastern governments,
yes,
which seems to be an abject failure.
Based on what?
Based on the fact that, well, I guess maybe it's too early to see results, but
yeah.
women are being elected to offices in some countries because they're women, because there have to be half women elected. And, you know, they're not really, it's not democracy if you're voting for the brunette. You know, we need six brunettes.
Well,
in this.
So now we're getting back to the should you vote for Hillary just because she's a woman
right,
conversation.
Well,
okay.
Right, exactly.
I hear you. It's too early to tell whether that's working or not. But I think that the bigger issue that's being exploded by this new study from the Peterson Institute for International Economics is that quotas are, in fact, working in the sense that women who are in the C-suite – not just the women themselves, but those companies led by women outperform companies led by men by a pretty significant net profit of 6%. So what she's saying is, when you look at this study, we can stop talking about the fact that you should bring more women into positions of leadership. And it's more about you must do this because it helps your bottom line.
Now, wait. So I'm reading in your digest the piece you gave me.
Yep.
Another discovery that will fuel policy discussions. Quotas to mandate female representation on boards do not reduce or improve corporate performance.
Well, that's about quotas. Okay.
Right.
So the question is, do quotas hurt performance? And if they don't, so let's just follow the bouncing ball. If quotas aren't hurting performance, and if it's true that women-led companies are outperforming those led by men by 6%, why wouldn't you want more women in the C-suite and on the board?
Well, I would argue that the companies that are outperforming, the companies with the women on the board, are outperforming because in general they're more enlightened companies.
Absolutely.
So that's why it's not because there are 30% women making better decisions. It's that the culture in general,
which would be heavily influenced by the presence of women.
Yeah, but okay, it's a chicken and egg thing maybe then, because I'm saying that it's the company culture in general, one that would lead to women on the board. Not the women on the board.
You and I are taking different sides
right.
of that.
So if you
force
women on the board, I don't think that's necessarily going to make
it's
it a better culture.
It's not about forcing women on the board,
Well, that's
Steve.
What a culture is.
No.
I mean, a quota
it's
is.
It's not about forcing. It's about putting in place the standards by which you would have to try harder in order to accomplish your goal.
And if you failed?
At least you're in a situation where you're being held accountable for the effort.
We got 30 seconds left.
Steve, this is like an eight-hour debate.
Let's go to Sports Illustrated.
So this is big news, and Sports Illustrated Swimsuit Edition put out three covers this year, a plus-size model, mm-hmm. Ronda Rousey, and then their typical large-breasted naked woman. And so the real news here is that
they're not naked on the cover.
Well, they're pretty naked. Yeah. I mean, she's just covering herself with her hands. I'm sure a lot of people listening are now going to pull over to the side of the road.
Wait a minute. I just looked at the large size woman. I didn't look at the other ones.
You should look at, well, I actually think that's fantastic because my concern with this was, great, it makes a statement about body image and all of that, but most men will go right to the woman who's the traditional model.
I knew you were coming in today. Suzanne Mushin,
you really prepare,
the
Steve,
co-host of The Big Payoff. You can listen to that podcast at WGNplus.com. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Steve.
We'll take a break, and Suzanne will cool down after this on The Business Lunch. What a girl wants, what a girl needs, whatever makes me happy, sets you free, and I'm thanking you for knowing exactly what a girl wants. It's 12:51. You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, and you're listening to Christina Aguilera sing a song written by Shelley Pikin, and she joins us now on the phone line. Shelley, welcome to The Business Lunch.
Hi. Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah. How many times do you get tired of hearing that song at all?
Never.
No?
So, I will never get tired of hearing that.
I was going over earlier the list of artists you've written for: Natalie Cole, Selena Gomez, Celine Dion, The Pretenders. And just watching the Grammys last night, I thought it might be a good chance to catch up on. We talk about different businesses, different professions, and sort of the business of songwriting. You
you
obviously watch the Grammys in a way much different than most of us do. What did you think of it last night?
Yeah, you know what? I like to watch the Grammys as an observer. I try to take myself out of somebody who's been in the business and just look at it as anybody else would. I usually watch with a handful of friends that come over. We make a vat of chili, and we're all pretty much seasoned veterans, but we like to watch as anybody else would, and we love to be somewhat irreverent and give credit where it's due. I loved it. I mean, the company I keep while I watch it is a whole lot of fun, and you don't know my voice normally, but I'm a little hoarse now just from all the screaming and yelling and all the opinions flying.
Well, I know. I was just from reading a couple of your blog posts that you were hoping that Dave Bassett, who wrote X's and O's, would win.
Yes.
It didn't happen for him last night.
Yes, but I'm very happy for all the winners. I love Alabama Shakes. I love Dave. First of all, I love that El King album because I really think it's great. Not just the one song, but many songs on it. And Dave Bassett has just been a serial songwriter, just like I have been for years and years. He's not actually the artist that made the record. He's been working as an outsider with artists and writing songs for pop stars at large. And so I always have to be, I'm always a little biased to the person who's been in it almost as long as I have, or as long as I have, coming at it from the outside, if they do great work. And that was a great song, X's and O's.
That is a nice song. You know, but so let's talk a little bit about the profession and where you are.
Yes.
And I want to talk about melodic math.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's a threat to you. I mean, it's the melodic math is, that's sort of like where they use an algorithm to write a song, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, you must be referring to, are you referring to my blog where I refer to Max Martin and John Seabrook's book, the Song Machine?
Yeah, right.
Where there's a, you know, Max Martin is one of the most successful producers currently, and he's going to be around for a long time because he's very talented, but a lot of what labels are looking for now are what they find through data and algorithms, what already works. So a lot of songs out there sound like a lot of songs that have been out there. And a lot of songs are written by melodic math, refers to the algorithms and the data, what works melodically, what has been proven. Is it a threat to me? Not really, because not every song is written that way, and styles and song fashion come and go. I can't write that way, although I listen to a lot of songs that have come out of the studio that have been written that way, and I'm a fan of those songs. Doesn't mean that I have to adhere to those that new process, and I don't think it's going to be forever. So there's no judgment here. There's just an acknowledgement that a lot of songs are written according to algorithms of success.
All right, so here we are in the digital age. It's so much easier to buy individual songs, so much easier to buy songs. You know, the show Beautiful is still playing in Chicago. I maybe just left. The Carole King show. And I learned a lot there about Tin Pan Alley and how songs were written back in those days. Obviously, they're written very differently today. But tell me about how a songwriter then compares to a songwriter now when it comes to commercially, because I would imagine it's much easier for someone to buy your song, but maybe it's much harder for you to benefit from that purchase.
Well, we're getting into there, you know, in the Brill Building, when the show Beautiful was out and that we got to see what was going on inside the Brill Building, there was no digital marketplace. And that was a time when a songwriter coming up in the business could actually take a demo of a song that they wrote that they felt was remarkable and just send it to an A&R person at a label. It was always hard back then, but there was a chance that an A&R person who was sitting behind a desk might receive your song and listen to it, and they didn't care who you were, what camp you were with, who published it, if the song was really remarkable, and it was the best song for Whitney Houston, that song could get cut. Now there's a digital world, and the technology has changed who can be songwriters. There's a lot more of us, and it's harder to be in Nebraska and just write a song and send it in. I think a songwriter these days has to be in the community, have relationships, be in songwriting camps. And when we talk about revenue streams, the digital marketplace has changed the way songwriters get paid, because when the laws were put into effect regarding the rate songwriters got paid, digital wasn't even in somebody's mind. Nobody knew that there'd be a digital universe.
Sure.
So the rates that songwriters get paid now for digital streaming are unsustainable. I mean, there are two different things here. There's a songwriter getting heard, and there's a songwriter, the ability for a songwriter to get paid.
Or to be fed to be heard, right?
I'm sorry?
I said there's the ability to be heard, but there's the need to be fed so you can be heard in the future.
Right. There's so much content out there, and it's easy. It's a do-it-yourself world. You could upload it. You could be on YouTube. Your social media could be out of the park, but it doesn't mean you're going to be paid for your material. And it's very complicated, but I do a lot of advocating for songwriters in D.C., how we need to raise streaming rates so the songwriter could get paid.
There's more on that at your blog, and people can find that, Confessions of a Serial Songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
The book is coming out. I can't wait for the book.
The book comes out March 22nd.
I'm sorry.
You can order now on Amazon. Thank you for mentioning it.
You bet. I hope that we can talk again when the book comes out, because I have a lot more I'd like to talk to you about.
There is so much more to talk about, Steve. Thank you for having me.
Shelly Piken, thanks very much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Have a good one.
You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.